The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at
imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If there were a mascot for video games, it would almost certainly be the suspender-wearing, mustachioed plumber Mario.
It's me, Mario!
Last week marked the 30th anniversary of the Nintendo game in which he was first given a name, Super Mario Brothers. Since then, Mario has appeared in more than 200 games across a number of consoles, making him the avatar behind the video game industry's best-selling franchise of all time. John Irwin teaches at Georgia Gwinnett College and is author of a book about Super Mario Brothers 2, and he's also a contributor to Killscreen, which celebrated Mario's 30th birthday with a collection of articles. John, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you on this August 30th anniversary of Super Mario Brothers. But technically, Mario was around even before then. Can you tell us a little bit about his creation?
That's right. Well, he was quote-unquote born on 1981 in the game Donkey Kong, which first was an arcade game, but he wasn't actually named. He was just colloquially referred to as Jumpman because that's really all he did. He walked left and right, climbed a ladder, jumped over barrels, and it wasn't until a couple years later when that same character became Mario in the arcade game Mario Brothers, and that's where we found him going through pipes and kicking turtles for the first time, the same kind of thing that we would see a couple of years later in Super Mario Brothers, which really kind of began the phenomenon as it remains today.
Well, I imagine that phenomenon when there were very few options for video game figures. But now we're talking about 30 years, thousands of well-developed characters and symbols and games since. Why has Mario hung on?
You know, I don't know that there's a great answer to how he's hung around. The best answer I can think of is that Nintendo has made sure that the games starring Mario have been high quality, really good experiences. They haven't just cashed in year after year. They did once with a feature film starring Dennis Hopper and John Leguizamo in 1993. It got trashed by critics.
Yeah, we don't talk about that very much, do we?
We don't talk about, yeah, exactly. We don't talk about that film, and yet we're talking about the games 30 years later because the games have remained incredibly good and replayed and loved by people decades after they play it.
But do you think he is, for the video game industry as a whole, an icon or nostalgia?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because so many people grew up playing this game. I remember the first time I played Super Mario Brothers on the NES. It was my older brother's system. And I think a lot of people grew up encountering this character as a young, impressionable person. And then now, looking back, they hold that nostalgia. It's a strange mix of very careful brand management, I think, from Nintendo. They have incredibly detailed style guides as to what Mario can and can't do or say. You know, they try to manage him as you might a celebrity or a star, knowing the impact that he can have and knowing that any damage will effectively, you know, destroy 30 years of built-up reputation.
Do people still play the original Super Mario Brothers?
They do, yeah. One thing that's interesting is that Nintendo, starting with their Wii system in 2006, began this this download service called the Virtual Console, where people can pay to download old classic games. So for $5, you could download the original Super Mario Brothers. Even just last night, I was watching television, and there was a what was it? It was a Fruit Loops TV commercial with a 30-something couple. They open this box of Fruit Loops. They take a big whiff from the box, and they look at each other and say, "Yeah, let's do this." And it cuts to the television, and they're playing Super Mario Brothers. So there is this weird mix of nostalgia, and also, you know, it remains fun. It remains fun to play.
And the old school games are apparently very popular with a crowd that you call the speedrunners. Now, what is that? Mm-hmm.
So they try to perfect and maximize the efficiency in all kinds of games. Last fall, I spoke with Andrew Gardakis, who for a long time was the world record holder in completing Super Mario Brothers in the fastest time possible, which was just under 5 minutes. So he plays through the entire game in 5 minutes. He's younger than the game itself, but something about the game has made him and thousands of others love to play and practice as you would, you know, a sport or any kind of skill in order to try to attain this mastery and this expert level of play.
So what's next for Mario?
The game that is just coming out to celebrate this anniversary, called Super Mario Maker, kind of tries to answer that question by giving the players the ability to create their own levels for these games for the very first time. It's basically this interactive level editor. I don't know what Nintendo has up their sleeves for 31, 32, you know, the 40th anniversary of Mario. I have a feeling they'll keep it fresh and keep players coming back. I'm excited to see what happens.
Well, I have a theory that Mario and Luigi have together inspired the mustache trend.
Well, Mario is supposed to be from Brooklyn. He did presage the Williamsburg hipster community.
When plumbers did actually live in Williamsburg.
Yeah, that's right. I don't think he'd be able to afford the rent now. Maybe he lives in Queens. I don't know.
I'm going to stay with that image. And thank you, John, so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Virginia.
John Irwin, he's author and contributor to Killscreen, where you'll find his article, Why We Love Mario. There's a link to read it at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we heard about the 30th anniversary of Super Mario Brothers. Well, one thing keeping classic games like that alive is a trend called speedrunning. But speedrunning isn't just a strange style of gameplay. It's also a vehicle for raising a lot of money. Paul Biseglio is an associate editor at Zocalo Public Square and contributor to Pacific Standard, where he recently wrote about awesome games done quick. It's a fast-growing event that is raising millions for charity. Hello, Paul.
Hi.
So real quick, remind us of what speedrunning is.
Sure. Speedrunning is a style of gameplay where the gamer tries to complete a video game in as little time as possible. And these are not games that are designed for racing or designed for fast play. They're usually adventure games, long, drawn-out games. But these gamers are beating them in a matter of minutes.
So how speedy? Give us some comparative times, like you playing Super Mario Brothers versus a speedrunner.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, a game like Super Mario 64, which is like a really popular Nintendo 64 game, average player might take 5, 6, 7, even more hours, depending on how deep they want to go into the game, how much they want to do. The world record currently for that game is under 7 minutes.
Wow. That is incredible. So they know a variety of tricks to beat games faster than we mere mortals. What kind of tricks are we talking about?
There's sort of two kinds of tricks. So on one level, the speedrunners are spending literally thousands of hours working on these games. So they pretty much just perfect the moves in the game, just like, you know, a professional dancer would perfect a dance. They move through these worlds with complete fluidity, and every move is, you know, the exact right way to get from point A to point B. On the other hand, they also, in the process of exploring these games, come up with all of these tricks and glitches. Like, they exploit mistakes in the game to be able to cut out like huge, massive portions and skip through levels.
So people just sit and watch them play. What's the appeal of watching a speedrunner?
It's funny. Yeah, this is a big question. Actually, Jimmy Kimmel actually just got in a bunch of trouble. He kind of went on a rant about how it sounds super boring to watch people play video games. I think there are two aspects to this. On the one hand, at a base level, it is just entertaining in a lot of ways. Like these speedrunners, they're so good at what they do that it is akin, I already mentioned, it's sort of like watching a professional dancer. Like there's everything's so choreographed and the acrobatics are so perfect when you watch that it's fun to see. On the other hand, there's also a nostalgia aspect. Just like somebody who grew up in their backyard playing football might like to watch football on television, these video gamers grew up playing these games, and it's exciting to see people play games at a level that you never thought was possible.
Is that why they choose these classic games like Super Mario or Legend of Zelda?
I think so, yeah. And speedrunning is such a big culture now that there are gamers playing new games, old games, but the most popular ones are the classic games exactly for that reason, I think.
So what you wrote about were these events in this organization called Awesome Games Done Quick. What's their story?
It's a charity group. It's actually, so Awesome Games Done Quick is the name of one of two marathons put on by a charity organization called Games Done Quick. Awesome Games Done Quick is in the winter, and they also do a summer marathon called Summer Games Done Quick. They were started in 2009 by a guy named Mike Uyama, who's just a young guy just out of college. He started it with a small group of people who were really into the speedrunning culture, who stayed in touch online and in chat forums, and who shared videos of games with each other. Originally, they planned on meeting at a gaming festival outside of Washington, D.C., but when they all gathered there was actually an internet problem, and in the sort of perfect irony, they ended up in Mike Uyama's parents' nearby basement and played.
Well, how big are these events now? They're really drawing in some money.
Yeah, so that it's come a long way. So that was, 5-6 years ago, and they raised about $10,000 in a few games of playing. Now they hold the Awesome Games Done Quick is held still outside Washington, D.C., but it draws in an in-person crowd of 1,000 people with many, many thousands more viewers, and they raise millions of dollars now.
We're talking about the growing movement of speedrunning charity events. That's electronic gaming for spectators to make money for charity. Paul Basiglia wrote about the phenomenon for Pacific Standard magazine. Well, let's hear a quick clip from one of these events. This is just before the start of a speedrun of the original Legend of Zelda game. Now, this was released in the U.S. in 1987.
So we are live, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank real quick you. Before you get going, I have a $50 donation from Fred and the Randomizer Sing. Dear Jay Coper, I just want to tell you both good luck. We're all counting on you. Runner's choice for what the donation goes to. P.S. Fred says the sword can be found near the start.
I've never, what?
He's never seen the sword in his life, so, no.
So how do they actually make money on these?
Yeah, this is part of the magic of the event. The marathon is streamed on a website called Twitch, which is a website designed specifically for video game streaming. And many viewers will tune in, and everybody watches. And the marathon hosts, on screen, you'll see a group of people playing video games. And then, usually off screen, they have a host who will do sort of commentary, narrate what's going on in the screen. And that host will solicit donations. And so they'll create these incentives, like if you want the player to take this path in the game, donate $10.
Right.
And people, all the viewers, the many thousands of viewers, will send in money to these different incentives. And they can donate directly through Twitch. So Twitch, the website, has a kind of a built-in donation widget, actually. So you can just plug in your credit card information and donate right while you're watching.
We have talked about Twitch before in this program. Hundreds of channels, millions of viewers. But which charities do they support?
Awesome Games Done Quick supports Prevent Cancer Foundation, which is a Northern Virginia-based nonprofit. Summer Games Done Quick supports Doctors Without Borders, which is a pretty well-known charity. And then there's a large crop of much smaller speedrunning charity marathons that pop up throughout the year that support pretty much every charity you can think of.
Which is interesting because you're having charity events that seem to have very little to do with the groups that they're actually benefiting. You're not walking for cancer or biking for good health. Do you think that what they're doing is different than other types of charity events?
Yeah. And there is some irony there, right? That, you know, they're video gaming for health, which is not usually associated with healthy activity.
But I suppose they're doing it quicker, so you're spending less hours in front of the screen.
That's a good point, right? Yeah, that's as quick as you can get away from the screen. But yeah, so I think, I mean, it's definitely not completely different from other charities. Like at base, they're still just like a charity run is getting a group of people together who are passionate about a certain activity. A speedrun marathon is getting people together who are passionate about speedrunning. But I do think that going back to Twitch, I think the medium is the real difference here. The people who organized the event, the guy named Mike Uyama and his group, are so good at soliciting donations. The way they run the event and the way they bring viewers in by getting them excited about speedrunning is unique. And then the fact that they're working through Twitch and they're working through this new technology that allows viewers to just kind of donate freely on the fly is really adding, I think, a pretty new dimension to it.
Well, another departure here is that you make this argument that these charity electronic gaming events, which really sound pretty passive for audience members or viewers, it really is an involved community experience. Now, why do you say that?
This is very true. And I think this is also part of the magic, so to speak, about these events and why they're so successful. So in reporting the piece, I spent a couple of days at Awesome Games Done Quick. And I actually stayed up for 24 hours straight, and just because nobody sleeps during these things, you know, they're nonstop. And at, you know, 4 a.m, when every sane person is sleeping, you know, I was there walking through the halls, and there's kind of a nonstop enthusiasm about education and sharing within the speedrunning community. So the best gamers will take the time to sit down with people who are just getting into it, and they'll, you know, they'll be at a television playing their game, and they'll kind of get a little crowd of younger and more inexperienced players gathering around them, and they'll sort of walk the gamers through the, you know, they'll be like, oh, this is how you do this trick. This is how I do this. There's a real enthusiasm for sharing and for collaboration in tackling a game.
I'm thinking of some of these charity events, like 5Ks have kind of lost steam. You know, they're getting more and more extreme. I'm wondering what you think about the longevity of speedrunning as a trend and as a charity event. Do you think this is going to last?
I do. And I mean, esports, which is like electronic sports, the idea of video gaming as a sport, are only on the rise. Like, there's no question about that. ESPN is actually hiring an esports reporter right now, or an editor to like cover esports, which I thought was funny. So as an activity, I mean, all of the metrics suggest that speedrunning is only on the rise. You know, they're gaining more and more money every year. More and more people are playing. And as a charity as well, I mean, I can only speak to the data, right? And so far, they've pretty much exponentially increased the amount of money they're getting as donations every year. So it seems to be going up for the foreseeable future.
Well, Paul, thank you for speaking with us.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Paul Basiglio, he wrote about competitive electronic gaming for charity for Pacific Standard Magazine. There's a link to read the article at wordofmouthradio.org. If you're looking for one more reason to convince your parents or spouse or friends that video games are good for you, try this one on for size. Video games are helping to advance scientific research. Stephanie Vogt is host of the podcast Experimental and has this update.
Game designers are now harnessing the appeal of video games to help solve difficult scientific problems. These scientific discovery games rely on the player's intuition and pattern recognition skills to solve problems that computer algorithms often struggle with. One of the most widely known science games is Foldit. The goal of this game is to puzzle out the three-dimensional structure of protein molecules. Proteins are built of long chains of amino acids and are the molecular machines that carry out thousands of different tasks in living cells. The amino acid chains twist, turn, and fold to form a three-dimensional structure that is unique and critical for the function of each protein. Scientists can easily determine the order of the amino acids in the chain, but figuring out the 3D structure of the protein is a much more difficult and expensive task. This is where the gamers come in. Foldit players are provided with a series of loops and zigzags representing the amino acids of a protein. By moving, shaking, and wiggling the lines, they compete and collaborate with one another to find the most stable possible 3D structure for the protein. Even though most Foldit players have little or no training in biochemistry, they have made some important scientific achievements. They figured out the structure of a protein from the Mazin-Pfizer monkey virus, which causes a disease similar to AIDS in monkeys. They also tweaked the structure of an industrially important enzyme to make it 18 times more efficient. In many cases, players have come up with better solutions than computer programs designed to solve the same problem. Given the success of Foldit, it's not surprising that scientists are now enlisting gamers to solve other problems. Some of the other games in this genre include Phylo, where players line up DNA sequences from a variety of animals, and Whale FM, where players find matches between different orca or pilot whale calls. So next time you're bored, give one of these games a try. Then you'll have a good reason for your hours spent playing computer games. It's all in the name of science.
That was Stephanie Vogt. She's host of the podcast Experimental. There is a link to download and play Foldit at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Paul Zaloom is a puppeteer and political satirist, but you may know him best as Beekman, the zany scientist from Beekman's World, who answered questions submitted by viewers.
Now, let's make a submarine in the comfort and privacy of our very own ocean.
Well, he'll be taking on much more nuanced questions at this year's Puppets in the Green Mountains Festival in Vermont. White Like Me, a hunky-dory puppet show, is Zaloom's two-part puppet piece about race and privilege and the role of a once mighty white man in a country where they're quickly becoming a minority. Some big issues in his tiny toy theater. And Paul Zaloom, welcome to the program. We'd love to ask you more.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
So this is not the first time that you're using a forum sort of made for kids that turns out to have a very big following with adults. Is the Beekman Show part of this evolution?
Not really. I got involved with puppetry through the Bread and Puppet Theater when I was 19 at Goddard College up in central Vermont. So, you know, puppetry is obviously considered in our culture as being a medium for children. It's, you know, traditionally been an adult medium that's had a lot to do with political satire and social satire. So we didn't really do kids shows. I mean, we did shows that kids could come to. Maybe they'd understand some of them. Maybe they wouldn't. And the same for my own work when I started doing my own puppet shows. And the Beekman job I got because of a slideshow I had done for adults about food called P-H-O-O-D. And they liked it, and I got that job, and then I actually did become a performer for children.
Well, I want to go back to this idea of puppetry as a vehicle for satire. It's long been true. What can you tell us about that tradition?
Well, if you look at let's say Punch and Judy, for example, or other archetypical male bad boy characters, rascal characters, characters like Petrushka from Russia or Guignol in France and Karagoz in Greece and Turkey. These were puppets that violated social norms, and they could get away with saying political things because the authorities, being, you know, by nature kind of stupid, saw that there was an intermediary between what was being said and who was saying it. So since it was the puppet saying it, they, you know, you could just get away with more.
Well, your Punch and Judy characters are both men. It was your production. And they find a baby to bring up. So how did this work for you, this social satire, two men playing Punch and Judy?
Yeah, Punch and Jimmy is the name of the show. And, the story is fairly simple, that Punch usually kills his partner. I didn't do that in my show for a host of reasons, but anyway, his boyfriend Jimmy leaves him, and then in the traditional story, the cop comes to arrest him. Oh, he throws the baby out the window, kills the baby accidentally, and the cop comes to arrest him, and he kills the cop, and then the hangman comes to hang him, and he kills the hangman. Death comes to kill him, and he kills Death, and then the devil comes to take him to hell, and he you know, kills the devil. So that's the story that's existed for hundreds of years, and there's a lot of context, a lot of opportunity for political satire. So the cop was LAPD, and it was a little bit about the Rampart scandal, which was going on in the 90s when I wrote the show, and the hangman had something to do with capital punishment, and death, well, death just is death.
No satirizing death.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is funny to confront it, you know, fear of it and all the rest of it. And I did do that. I like taking traditions and then manipulate them or using them to my own evil purposes.
Tell us about your new work, White Like Me, a hunky-dory puppet show. What are we going to find there?
Well, the show came out of a very weird thing. I went to a conference, a National Performance Network conference, and we all get to pitch the projects we're going to work on that are coming up. And I had an idea for a project, and the night before, some other folks were pitching their projects, and a lot of them were people of color talking about projects that related to their experience, their cultural backgrounds, and, you know, things that had happened to them, their lives as whatever race or ethnicity they were. And I was sitting there, and I said to myself, gee, what about me? And then I said, ooh, that's really weird. I thought, that's really weird. That's really kind of creepy. So I got the idea right away, I should do a show about being white, because I just thought that since this happened myself and my attitude, I thought, boy, there's a lot of rich material in there. So basically what I do in part one, I don't want to scare your listeners, but I do a ventriloquist act with a traditional ventriloquist figure that I've found in a trunk, and he comes alive. And he's been gone for 50 years, so I'm sort of hipping him to what's transpired. And I think that's an interesting avenue for me, is the idea of privilege, mm-hmm. and kind of exploring that. And then I do a toy theater show, which is, you know, this little miniature proscenium theater, and I use toys and tools and objects, packaging material, all kinds of crud in this little miniature theater. And in that show, it's kind of a fictional history of white man who comes from the planet Caucasoid and lands on Earth and, you know, civilizes it and, you know, becomes a great philanthropist. And it's a comedy, believe it or not.
Let's hear just a clip from that. This is from The Adventures of a White Man, part two of the upcoming production, White Like Me, a hunky-dory puppet show.
My friends, white man is having a flashback. Holy cow, it's a flashback. Remember this from earlier? It had the barbed wire on it? Yes. And white man's wondering, oh, where's the place for me? Where do I fit into this picture? What happens? Look, a white is a color too. Damn it all, I swear.
Paul Zaloom there. What are you doing? You're just flashing a keep out sign. That's what the white man used to live behind.
Yeah, it's an ironic flashback, the keep out sign, because it's something that appears earlier when white man is kicking little green aliens out of Arizona over the border back into Mexico. So, you know, the keep out is in that scene and then comes back to haunt him. And a lot of it is about Caucasian anxiety about becoming a minority, which is supposedly going to happen in 2042. It's already happened in California. And I think it's a really interesting phenomenon. I was thinking about stopping doing this show and writing a new show, but given what's happened nationally and issues around race, I've gotten a lot more interested in keeping it and, you know, to continue doing it because it is so relevant and I have so much fun doing it. And I just think it's hilarious for me to look at myself and my whiteness and make fun of myself and connect with other Caucasians who may just see how ridiculous the whole race thing is to begin with.
You're going to be performing this in Vermont, home of Senator Bernie Sanders. He's been challenged recently at public events for saying all lives matter in response to Black Lives Matter protesters. Any way that you would counsel Bernie on handling this or being as vulnerable as I think you're trying to be with this show?
I think because he lives in a really white state and in a really white environment, it's really hard to be connected to what's going on in the bigger picture racially. And I don't think that's his fault or anything else. I tell you what's really changed my thinking. And they're very minor incidents, but I went to a gallery opening in Westminster in Orange County, California, and I was the only Caucasian there. And it just struck me like, oh, okay, this is what this is like. All of a sudden, I became aware of the fact that I was white, because we white folks, we just think of ourselves as generic people. It's all the other people who have all these colors. Unless you're in the KKK or the Nazi Party, you don't strut around saying, I'm white, I'm white. You're just a generic person. But once you're put into that kind of situation, you all of a sudden realize, oh, actually, I do have an identity. People do see me this way. And that's quite a head-turner. I mean, when I was 16, I was taken to a Black Panther meeting in New Haven, Connecticut, and I was the only white person there. I was taken by some black friends in high school, and that was my first introduction to the idea of being a minority of one in a room, and that also had a profound effect. So, you know, my advice to Bernie would be, you know, get into a situation where he's the only white dude in a big room full of folks.
Well, Paul Zaloom, thank you so much for speaking with us, and welcome back to Vermont very soon.
Well, thanks so much. It was really sweet of you to have me on the show.
Paul Zaloom's White Like Me, a Hunky Dory puppet show is on for two shows on Friday, September 11th at the Puppets in the Green Mountains Festival. There are many more shows for adults and for kids in the Brattleboro area from the 11th to the 20th, including Bread and Puppet Theater, who Paul mentioned. There's much more on the schedule and the festival at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There were times when Asif Manvi's interviews for The Daily Show were just plain cringeworthy. Here he is with Don Yelton, former North Carolina GOP precinct chair and member of the state's Republican Party Executive Committee.
But I think I've treated you the same as I would anybody else.
Right.
Matter of fact, one of my best friends is black.
So one of your best friends?
One of my best friends.
Is black.
Yes.
Yelton also complained that only African Americans can use the N-word and thought it just fine if the state's mandatory voter ID law, quote, hurts a bunch of lazy blacks. He was asked to resign the day after the interview ran. It was never Manvi's goal to be a muckraking gotcha journalist. Fake reporter is just one of the many roles he's taken on as an actor. But then Manvi had a number of identities thrust upon him since he moved from India to England and then to Florida as a high school junior. He writes about many of them in a collection of essays called No Land's Man, which is now out in paperback. I spoke with Asif Manvi when the book first came out last fall and asked him about that interview with Don Yelton. What was he thinking while it was happening?
I think in that moment, you know, you really just want to stay out of the way. The impulse is always to try to, you know, drive the bus somewhere, you know, so you have something in the interview. And then something like that happens where he just starts to speak like that. And then, you know, it reminded me something Stephen Colbert said to me when I first started at The Daily Show, which is that when you know, put a camera in someone's face, they get a lobotomy. And and I thought to myself, oh, this is happening. And it never had the consequence that it had with Don Yelton, but it has happened in many other interviews. So I knew well enough to just stay out of the way.
Yeah.
and let him keep going. And I knew that we were getting great stuff. And it's, you know, in spite of all the sort of things he was saying, you know, as a Daily Show reporter, your heart just gets filled up with when that kind of thing happens.
Well, I remember you interviewing a woman who said some, you know, crazy things like, oh God, what was it? Something like a third of Muslims are terrorists.
Yeah, one out of every five Muslim is a terrorist or something like
but
that.
I mean,
which I think.
Is it ever infuriating? Do you ever think, I just want to strangle this person?
Right. I mean, you know, there was a string of interviews that I did for a while there where I was talking to a lot of like Muslim haters. And that started to get to me a little bit after a while. And I remember talking to John and just saying like, you know, maybe I'll just go out and talk to somebody, you know, just a regular kind of nut job, you know. And that woman actually that I spoke to in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, she was a particular, very specific kind of crazy. Like she actually, I think I said to her in the interview that, you know, I'm Muslim. And she said something innocuous like, oh, I figured you were. And then we were changing tape and she her husband off to the side said, "Hey, honey, you know, next time he asks you, tells you that you're Muslim, maybe you can say, not everyone's perfect." Ooh. And so she asked us to actually go back and ask her the question again because she thought, oh, this will be really funny. And of course, again, it was a moment where I was just like, my heart filled, you know, and I thought, this is, she has no idea what she's about to do, you know.
Now, this is a job that you almost didn't take. You write in one of the essays, you were in a funk, you were writing a letter to your mm-hmm. ex-girlfriend, recently engaged. When you got the call about auditioning for The Daily Show and you said, well, I'm going to give you the polite version. I'm not talking to them right now. Why?
You know, they called and they said The Daily Show is looking for a Middle Eastern looking guy. And I thought, well, this is either the most elaborate Homeland Security sting operation I've ever heard of, or I'm going to end up down at The Daily Show studios, like putting on a fake beard and some sketch and yelling death to America or something like that. So I was like, forget it. I'm not doing that. I'd done these kinds of things before, Letterman and Jimmy Kimmel and, you know. And so I thought, I'm not doing it. And so I said no. And then they called back and they said, oh, actually, it's for a correspondent. And they would like you to come down by 3 o'clock. So I literally got down there at 3 o'clock. And then John hired me right there. And then I was on the show that evening. It was on the air later that night. And then I didn't have time to tell anybody. And then my phone just started ringing at 11:30 that night, you know. People, did I just see someone who looks very much like you on The Daily Show? You know, that kind of thing.
Well, in the book, we learn a lot about your parents. You know, there are a lot of stories about them. And their response to this offer was, is this John Stewart fellow crazy? What?
Yeah. Well, my dad said, you know, is this John Stewart fellow crazy? How can he hire someone who doesn't even know how to say salam alaikum to be his senior bloody Muslim correspondent? And I said, you know, Dad, it's a comedy show. And he said, I hope it's a comedy show. You know, because I was the last person to represent Islam or Muslims in any way. You know, I've been in more bars than mosques in my life. And so it was kind of bananas for me that I would even be representing in this way, you know. But as I was on The Daily Show and as the years went by, I realized like, oh, I was able to speak into the zeitgeist in some way. And it was really affecting American Muslims, more than it was affecting policy or lawmakers or the media. It was affecting American Muslims, and they were excited about it. And that sort of, in a weird way, sort of made me feel kind of Muslimy, you know, and it was very uncomfortable.
We're speaking with Asif Manvi, who is an actor who many people may know as from The Daily Show. His new collection of essays is called No Land's Man. Why did your family actually move to the U.S.?
They moved to the U.S. because... Well, my dad, he always wanted to move to Canada, actually. And then he found an old college buddy of his who lived in Tampa, Florida. And he was like, Tampa, it's the great American city. It's the city of the future. Come here. So he came out to America on a reconnaissance mission just to check out Florida. And I guess somebody took him out to eat brunch. And he fell in love with the idea of brunch. And I think he thought it was like a third meal. And I have a whole story about it in the book about how he... called us from Florida, and he was like, you know, in America, they have this thing, it's called brunch. They have so much food that between breakfast and lunch, they have to stop and eat again. Breakfast and he thought it was a combination. And he, you know, it was like he got here and it was like Willy Wonka's chocolate factory for my dad, you know. He sort of embraced the consumer culture with an open mouth, you know.
Well, this was in the 1980s. When The Cosby Show was on the air, and you do your own very funny bit from The Daily Show. It's a kind of riff on an integrated family. This is The Cosby Show. That's Q-U-apostrophe-O-S-B-Y.
Someone made snacks for his hardworking kids.
Oh, thanks, Dad. BLT.
Tommy, I made your favorite, baby back ribs. Tommy.
Yeah, Dad?
How many times have I told you not to listen to your iPod while you're doing your homework?
Your father's right, honey.
Yeah, but come on, it's the new Toby Keith album.
Oh, well, why didn't you tell us? What are you hogging it all to yourself for? Turn it off!
So there you are playing the Cosby dad. Tell us about that clip.
Well, we created this parody sitcom based on something that Katie Couric said, where she said, you know, maybe what American Muslims need is what African Americans had in the 80s, which was their own version of a Cosby show. Mm. And maybe that would help with some of the racism and bigotry. And so we took that to its literal extreme, because that's what we do on The Daily Show, and created the Cosby show, Q-U-apostrophe-O-S-B-Y. And it was the all-American Muslim family that we showed it to a panel of New Yorkers, and they thought it was we presented it like it was a real show, and we wanted to get their opinions, and we got some very interesting and scary responses.
What kind of faces were you seeing on television when you were growing up? I mean, obviously not any that looked very much like yours.
No, I mean, I decided I wanted to be an actor when I was very young. And, you know, my impression of sort of, and I grew up on American pop culture. I grew up on, you know, all the American 70s television shows. And, you know, I used to watch Happy Days, and I used to watch The Fonz. And I remember thinking, you know, that his name was Arthur Fonzarelli, and he was really cool. And so maybe me, with my dorky name, which was Asif Mandviwala, could also be really cool, you know, and I could be the Mons or something. And so then my mother, actually, when I told her I wanted to be an actor, she suggested that I look at Omar Sharif. And she said, you know, you want to be an actor like Omar Sharif. And I didn't know who Omar Sharif was. And then I saw him, and it was the first time that I saw a brown man in a Hollywood movie. Not
Zhivago,
playing a servant or Gunga Din or something, you know, and he was this man, he was a gentleman, and it gave me a possibility because he existed.
And also Michael Jackson, I guess you took on that role. It's a very, very funny story about you bringing the house down at a high school variety show, doing your Michael Jackson impersonation. But I thought even funnier was you rehearsing that for your grandparents. Tell us what happened.
Right, that story is a lot about, it's about Michael Jackson, but it's also about race. Mm. And, you know, this idea that, like, I decided that I could impersonate Michael Jackson. I realized I could moonwalk and I could sort of sing like him. And I had a jerry curl, and both of us looked like an Indian girl. So, you know, we kind of could match on that level. And so I put together this costume and the thing, and then I, you know, my grandparents were visiting from India, and of course they had no idea who Michael Jackson is or was, and I'm doing these spins and these things, and I'm falling down. It was very bad. It was not good. And my grandmother, God bless her, she was incredibly supportive, and for months afterwards, she would come into my bedroom and sort of, like, with a cheeky grin on her face, she would always say, "Billy Jesus, not my lawyer."
So many good stories in this book. They're so funny, but there's a lot of poignancy here of somebody kind of like viewing the world as the guy who's always had the roles, the names, the epithets kind of thrust upon him. And you even play with that a little bit in your book trailer. You know, you're not quite Muslim enough, you're not quite Indian enough, you're not quite English enough. Is that something you truly struggle with, or does it just make for great comedy?
Well, I think that, you know, look, the title comes exactly from that, the No Lands Man, you know, that sense of belonging nowhere and everywhere. And I think that theme of the outsider, which I think a lot of immigrants can relate to, you know, I had it on different continents. But as an adult, it kind of became, my multiplicity has become, I think, in some ways, my power, you know, at least that's how I look at it. And, you know, and especially when I got to The Daily Show, you know, the idea that I could inhabit this voice that was both an outsider and an insider at the same time was incredibly powerful. And I realized that, like, that was the uniqueness of my voice in terms of what The Daily Show was able to present. We are who we are, you know, and that was the sort of journey of what happened to me. But I feel like it kind of shaped me into who I am, and also perhaps, it has informed the kind of actor that I am as well.
And that was my earlier conversation with Asif Manvi about his collection of essays. It's called No Lands Man and is now out in paperback. There's much more on the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.